that much. There was some discussion in the committee about serving MPs being appointed to Chapter 9 bodies. We did refer it formally to the Parliamentary Law Advisers, who came back to say that there is no legal impediment why serving members should not be nominated and shortlisted. The only thing was, and we can make that opinion available to you, I think Advocate Jenkins is on his way, but we've got a copy. Obviously, should you be appointed, then by operation of law, you would not be able to serve in the National Assembly. So that's the only practicality around that. So there's no legal impediment as far as that is concerned.
May I say something about that, Tim? Thank you very much. When I applied for this position, I was cognizant of the fact that should I be appointed, I will have to resign, and I'm fully prepared to do so. I applied being aware of that legal requirement. Thank you.
Okay, then just as by way of an introduction, we've got your CV. Members have obviously read your CV, but just give us your background, your experience, and then after that we can open it up for members for questions.
May I just check if I'm allowed to look through the constitution and my notes through the interview? Thank you. Thanks. My name is Faith Kimento. I come from the Northern Cape by birth, and I was bred there as well. Although I have worked across South Africa doing various things, I worked in the underground structures of the African National Congress. I also operated above board on the structures of the United Democratic Front. I am a teacher by profession. I taught various subjects, largely science and mathematics, biological sciences included, but I also taught economics. I was not trained to teach economics, but when there was a shortage of posts, I was requested to do so, and I had to learn together with students to do that, but produced wonderful results on that field as well. I also worked as a manager in the Department of Education. I started at a deputy director level as a community development officer. I was designing educational programs that are meant to use education as a vehicle for community development. And I later got promoted to serve as a gender focal person for the department. I also was appointed by the former President Nelson Mandela and the then Minister of Health, Nkosazana Zuma, to sit in the South African Nursing Council as a public representative for the Northern Cape. I also sat on the Health Professional Council. I was largely rewriting in the Nursing Council. I was responsible, amongst others, to rewrite the programs, the education programs, the UN standards. I also sat on the South African Qualification Authorities on behalf of the South African Nursing Council with the issue of UN standards, etc., etc., and also pegging of qualifications. I dealt with ethical issues also, both for the South African Nursing Council and the Health Professional Council. I was also a councillor for the district municipality in the Northern Cape that is known as Francis Marks. I must say that I was instrumental in naming that municipality after a woman who is an unsung heroine of our struggle, who hails from my province but died as a pauper in banishment in Pretoria, outskirts of Pretoria. She was given a state funeral, state pauper funeral, buried as a pauper. So I led the council in renaming itself after her in that council, I was in the mayoral committee heading social development. I have a passion for human rights. That is the reason why I joined the ANC at a tender age of 13. That is why I also worked in the United Democratic Front. I also served in the NECC, the National Education Coordinating Committee, together with Randall van Heerfer and others. I was the youngest serving in that body. We were already at that time dealing with the problems of education under apartheid South Africa, but mapping the way forward for alternative education for a free South Africa. I was linking with parents and with students. I also assisted the DPSC, which was dealing with detainees at that time. And my focus was particularly on detained students. I was a detainee myself. I orchestrated the national hunger strike for political prisoners with my lawyer, who is Priscilla Jana, who is now our ambassador in the Netherlands. Together we smuggled out notes that put the plight of political prisoners before the international community and organized a national strike. My co-developer of that strategy and the program was the wife of the now chairperson of the National Assembly, Obed Mapela. Because of the skills I have acquired in dealing with the public in the mass mobilization phase for undoing apartheid, because of my expertise as a teacher, because of the knowledge I gained when I worked with professional bodies like the South African National Health Professional Council and the South African Nursing Council, and the exposure as a mayoral committee of the district municipality of Francisburg, and my passion for equality and human rights, I think I bring in a lot of expertise and skill. And I also now am serving as a public representative in the National Assembly. I chaired the caucus of the ruling party, which entailed dealing with rights of members. One right that you may want to, that you might be aware of, that I passionately push, is the right to be appropriately remunerated with dignity and without begging for that right. So when I saw that the Human Rights Commission has a position of all positions, I thought that I must take my service higher up. I'm currently studying for a master's degree in management with this university in the field of security studies. I'm doing research also as an elective of part of that study. My thesis is security and management related because of the management angle. I also deal with issues of finances and economics, international relations, etc. I can spend a whole day telling you about my experience, but I think I should pause here to create space for the panel to put its questions to me. I thank you.
Thanks. Over to members. Questions. Mr. Sibanyoni, Mr. Hubert, any other hands? Galeka, okay, and Mrs. Seaton, let's take those four in that order. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Shepherd. Ms. Mentor, I'm going to ask you two questions. The first one is, the Commission has an obligation to promote an awareness of human rights in the country. Do you think that this has been done successfully among the poor and marginalized? What innovative means would you adopt to promote public awareness of and access to the Commission? That's the first question. Do you want me to put both, all three of them, or you want to ask the first one?
Okay.
qualify as an executive?
Whatever you deem fit, so
okay.
I will abide to it.
The second one is the South African Human Rights Commission offices are located in urban areas, while those most vulnerable to human rights abuses live in rural areas. What should the Commission do to ensure that those living in the rural areas are reached? And then the last one, I think, would be explain why you believe you are the right person to serve as a commissioner.
May I go on, Chef? Thank you. Chef, frankly speaking, though I might, at the risk of sounding perfectionist, I don't think that the Human Rights Commission, whereas I will acknowledge that it is doing work in enriching the poor and marginalized and in making them aware of their rights, I think a lot still needs to be done. There is a tendency, not only in terms of the Human Rights Commission, but I will focus on the Human Rights Commission, that since our democracy, we have tended to put on a cap, a thinking cap, an urban thinking cap, when we develop legislation, when we develop programs, including reaching out programs. Most of the time, we make use of the instruments and which are easily reaching to those located in urban areas. The Human Rights Commission is also guilty, in my opinion, of this practice. We tend to communicate, they too tend to communicate by means of electronic communication, both print and otherwise. And I don't think that those are the means that necessarily reach the vulnerable, poor, particularly people in rural areas. If you will communicate largely by newspapers, the poor do not afford to buy a newspaper. They cannot access newspapers. Their burden is to put a loaf of bread daily on the table. Even if you want to communicate by radio, often it is in the medium of languages that the poor in the rural areas are not speaking. I myself am guilty of communicating through the radio, largely in Afrikaans and English. And even if there can be a radio service in any rural part of the country, if the Human Rights Commission is communicating using a radio that is normally expected to be accessible, but using English, that is a barrier to the poor. So I think that we can do better, and the Human Rights Commission can do better. If you consider that in every rural community, there should be a post office in close proximity. There is a school, even if it is a farm school. There is a church. The poor attend churches. I think those are institutions that can be used instead of relying on electronic media to communicate to the poor about their rights. I think there can be innovative ways. When I was a teacher, when I introduced myself, I said I am a teacher. I would take a school register, because at the back of a school register, normally, you are expected to, as a class teacher, write the profile of a child. You write whether the child is having a parent, both parents, you write the address, you write every other piece of information about the child. So I think those basic things that are already in existence, if you take a simple note, if you show up as a commissioner at a school in a rural area, or you develop a link with principals of schools in rural areas, or with priests in rural areas, you can be able to use the database like a database of a school register, even if it is a farm base, a farm school, to invite parents to sessions, by means of which, as a commission, you directly, or using the school as an already existing facility or a church, to talk to the poor directly, or form partnerships with schools and churches to bring the message of the rights of people, especially the poor, especially the socio-economic rights. So I think with a little bit of an innovation of studying what is it that we do have, where the poor are located, moving away from the overused media of communication that is normally in languages that the poor do not understand, can be a way of reaching out to the marginalized and the poor of our country. But lastly, the poor themselves have got a lot to teach all of us, including the Human Rights Commission, about how they must be reached and how they must be made aware. I can tell you lastly, Chairperson, that I chair a committee of parliament. I have bundles of letters from the rural communities, including people who say they are IFP, who wrote to me by a letter because I had invited them to write to me their feelings, to communicate their feelings about Flocross. I never managed to reach all the letters. I had eventually, I was forced to read a sample of the letters because I used the same methods that I am advocating as an innovation to communicate to them, to say that there is a matter before Parliament in my committee on floor crossing, and in various letters written in various languages, including speaking in those languages in the community radio stations, invited them to express their views, and from that I could solicit their view. They were opposed to floor crossing. So I think there are those innovative ways that the Human Rights Commission can use. The second question. The answers I provided for the first question would actually also apply to a certain extent to the second and third question, except that the third one asks, why am I the right person? I think that we should not make the poor, and the Human Rights Commission should also seriously ponder this. I come from the Northern Cape. If the Human Rights Commission has an office in the Northern Cape, which is a peri-urban province, it would be a thing of the recent past. The Human Rights Commission has not had an office even in Kimberley, which is the capital of the province. Now you can imagine what is the situation for people who are far flung from the urban areas like Kimberley. This is particularly the reason why I applied for this position. That I think that this thing of the Human Rights Commission having offices in urban areas needs to be corrected. That if we cannot put it, I do understand that because of financial constraints, you cannot have a Human Rights Commission office in every corner of South Africa. But I think we must use offices like the Constituency Office of Parliament to to, as the Human Rights Commission, where we cannot put an office, you will find such offices spread across the Republic. And they can be used by the Human Rights Commission to access the poor and the marginalized and to bring awareness to them about their rights. Why am I the right person? I have a grassroots background that I think the Human Rights Commission can benefit from. From my early days as a student throughout my working life to date, I have been crisscrossing not only my province, but the whole country, reaching out to people, speaking to them in their own languages. You may want to know, Jefferson, that I speak proficiently 7 African languages, and I can read and write all of them. Setswana, Sesotho sa Leboa, which is Sepedi, Sesotho sa Moshweshwe, Sezulu, Sexhosa, Sevenda, Siswati, and Ndebele. I cannot write Venda. I can read Ndebele. In fact, I did not know that Honorable Sibanyoni is Ndebele, because I normally listen to Ndebele news, and then one day I was listening to Ndebele news and I captured him speaking in Ndebele. So my rural baseness and connectivity and my grassroots connectivity is one thing. My research skills that I am acquiring, because one of the functions and the powers and roles of the commission is to do research. I have a research background that I think can add value to the Human Rights Commission. As I said when I introduced myself, I dealt with ethical issues for the Health Professional Council as well as the Nursing Council. It involved a lot of investigation. So I have also developed investigative skills in the process, which is one of the roles of the commission. So, and also being a teacher, I bring in the expertise to communicate broadly on issues of educating on the human rights and on raising awareness on the human rights. Having served as a parliamentarian and as a counselor, also have given me the leeway and the ability to be able to connect easily with other organs of state, which is a requisite, constitutional requisite for the Human Rights Commission, that annually the Human Rights Commission must, and I think it's one function that the Human Rights Commission is not doing adequately, of soliciting reports from organs of state annually in terms of what they are doing in terms of ensuring the human rights of people in terms of education, health care, food security, etc. I think those are the kind of things that I am bringing in. I will bring in should I be appointed into the Human Rights Commission.
Thanks. Before I allow the next question, just to welcome the Deputy Chairperson of the Human Rights Commission, Mrs. Zoki Magodina, who many of the members may know. Just to say that we've asked the Human Rights Commission just to make one of the commissioners available, because there might actually be questions from the candidates that we as a committee may not be able to answer. So thank you very much, and you know, for being available on such short notice. I've got 3 more hands that I saw, just bearing in mind we've only got 15 minutes, so if we could try to maybe limit it to 5 minutes per question. I've got Mr. Yubar, and then Mrs. Ngaleka, and then Mrs. Seaton.
Thank you, Jay. Ms. Mentor, I listened carefully to your opening address, and you mentioned a number of times your passion for human rights. But I wonder how passionate you really are, and I'll tell you why I'm asking this. I had a private member's bill to protect RDP homes against the execution steps. Said I had a private member's bill that was aimed to protect RDP homes against the execution steps. And your committee approved that, and it was under the line on the order paper for a long time, and then it disappeared. And I wrote to you personally a number of letters, and you didn't reply to any of them. Now my question is, if you're not passionate about something like protecting homes, how can you say you're passionate about human rights?
I will say that you are being personal. I'm sorry to say to put it this way to you as a panel member. However, I think the fact that you are acknowledging that the committee that I lead had approved your private member's bill and moving forward with it was a parliamentary matter. In your when you kept on corresponding to me, I kept on corresponding to the powers that be, which is Parliament. We had done what was within our power as a committee, and we had approved your bill. Now, the system of Parliament, deliberately or not deliberately, allowed that to move further and further down the line. That was something that was outside my powers. But I also had to communicate very carefully to you. I could not say it to you like I'm saying to you right now. What I did on your behalf, and which I communicated that to you, I regret the fact that you might not have received my correspondence. I kept on speaking, raising this matter on your behalf, and responding to only two communications, I must underline, from you regarding the matter. Further than that, the matter was outside my control. It was in the control of Parliament. I did what I had to do in agreeing with the right to housing as you were proposing in your bill, I think.
Mrs. Ngaleka?
Thank you, Chairperson. Ms. Lento, can you please give us your view on the following? The South African Human Rights Commission has recently faced some criticism on its handling of matters involving certain pronouncements by leaders, political figures. Comment on the manner in which the Commission handled these cases, and further, how would you have handled some of these controversial utterances by political figures? Lastly, can you explain to us how you will balance the need to show respect for customary law, which is protected by the Constitution, and promote equality among all Rwandan women? Thank you very much.
Can you repeat your second question, ma'am, please?
My second question is that... Oh, sorry. Can you please tell us how you would balance the need to show respect for customary law, which is protected by the Constitution, and promote equality amongst rural women? Thank you.
Ms. Ngaleka. The pronouncements by politicians I'm guessing right to say that you're referring to the utterances on the killing for an individual. Do I read your mind right? Okay. Thank you. In my opinion, those utterances were totally wrong. That's not what you're asking me. You're asking me how my opinion on how the Human Rights Commission dealt with the issue. I don't think that the Human Rights dealt completely correctly with the issue. I think the Human Rights Commission, in fact, I must call them what they are right name. I know they get correctly ucked when we don't say South African Human Rights Commission, SAHRC. The manner in which they took on the issue initially was very good. And for both Mr. Malema and for both Mr. Zwelinzima Vavi, they took the issue seriously as they should have. And they make pronouncements. I don't know if they investigated, but They even told the public that they don't take kindly to the remarks as they threaten democracy, etc., etc. Then they gave an ultimatum to the two gentlemen. And then they promised South Africa that if the two gentlemen did not withdraw the remarks within a given time frame, they were going to do 1, 2, and 3. Up to the point where the ultimatum expired, I think the Human Rights Commission of South Africa could have done better. When I take the case of Mr. Malema, Mr. Malema was accompanied by a leading figure a recognized leader. Now, the Constitution says that the Chapter 9 Constitution must do their work without fear, favor, or prejudice. I find them wanting. I think they cowered before Mrs. Mandela. What they came out with and what they had earlier pronounced on, they gave us the impression that they will act in the manner in which the Constitution expects them to act like, without fear, prejudice, and favor. Well, I am not fully aware of the facts pertaining to the meeting between Mr. Malema and Mrs. Mandela, but I saw an anticlimax. I was disappointed as a South African in the manner in which, after the meeting, the tone, the Human Rights Commission came out of that encounter after the meeting in a defensive mode. The tables had turned. It was actually Mr. Malema and Mrs. Mandela who were in charge, and the Human Rights Commission had to explain themselves why they somersaulted on their intended intention pronounced earlier, how they would deal with those people if they had not withdrawn the remarks. And I think that dented the image of the South African Human Rights Commission a little bit. I think that they should have lived through their intention not to be fearful of a ruling party or members of the ruling party. How interpreted it is because Mr. Malema was accompanied by a leading figure of the ruling party. So I could read a factor of fear, and I think it's not correct for the Chapter 9 institution to be put into a corner like that. They were on the right track, and eventually Mr. Malema, out of that meeting, did not show remorse or he changed the words. And Mr. Vabi, they were unapologetic, and I think the Human Rights Commission could have done better. They shouldn't have, at the end of the day, being the one that defends themselves against the right position they had taken to say that they would not accept that kind of communication in the public space, which was hate speech, which was not strengthening democracy. You asked me how I would balance customary law, which is protected by the Constitution, and equality of rural women. It's not an easy issue. I myself deal with a lot of, I am a gender activist. I have to deal with this issue when I defend women in rural areas. I think you have to firstly, when you deal with traditional, you have firstly to recognize traditional leadership, because it is recognized both by the Constitution and by our laws. And when you approach traditional leadership, you have to, in a very gentle way, advance the constitutional rights of, like, the rights to equality bestowed on women in a respectful way, in a manner that is not demeaning or is not looking down on the traditional leadership or system of traditional leadership. Because traditional leadership, in my view, is custodians or are custodians of customary law. So you have to be gentle, much as you, if you just throw the Constitution at traditional leadership, in cases where equality of women is eroded, you are likely to find a resistance, because traditional leadership will also throw the constitution back to you and show you the chapter which protects them. So I think you have to find a way in which you very gently take them along the way, but the first step is to acknowledge them, their system, and also protected by the constitution, and together with traditional leadership, find ways and means of securing women equality. I don't think that you can succeed to do so without the buy-in of traditional leadership and recognition of traditional leadership as custodians of customary law.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Most of my questions have been answered. And before I ask the next question, perhaps I should not that I think Ms. Mentor needs to send me, because I think she's perfectly capable of sending herself. But just to say that the process, I fully support what she says, what she does with the bills once they go beyond. Yes, I just want to come back to that. If she doesn't have control, the chairperson of that committee no longer has control of those bills once they pass. I have a bill that I know Ms. Mentor was particularly passionate about, and there's nothing that she or I can do about it at this stage. So just before that. Your comments, Ms. Mentor, with regard to the role of the South African Human Rights Council with Parliament, in Parliament, parliamentary process, what would you say that should be?
Could you
What do you believe should be the role of the SA Human Rights Commission with regard to the parliamentary process? How do you think that human rights should be fitting into the parliamentary process?
I think that the Human Rights Commission should not only annually bring a report to Parliament and depend on and leave it to Parliament to interrogate report. I think there are often cases where Parliament also fails to rise to the occasion of securing human rights. I don't know a stage of any stage where the Human Rights Commission, as prescribed by the Constitution, said to Parliament as an organ of state, what is it that you have done so far to secure human rights as the Constitution mandates them? I think that their duty goes beyond reporting to Parliament. They should also hold Parliament accountable. In terms of, it's a counter, both of them hold, they report to, but also you must ask Parliament, what are you doing in terms of redressing human rights, etc. For instance, if I can take the issue of Kutsong, I think that Kutsong, Matatiele, etc., that's one example in which the Human Rights Commission of South Africa could have said to Parliament, apart from their annual report, our view on this matter. Is that in the past year you have pushed this legislation, but you are supposed to secure the rights of people in terms of this and that. Give us a report in terms of how you did it, and then we will advise you on it. So I think they should also hold Parliament responsible in terms of what they are doing in terms of human rights.
We are running a bit short of time, but yeah, Mr. Masita, we could probably squeeze it in another if we go 5 minutes over, and then we can wrap up. Thanks.
But I think that there's just one or two questions I felt I needed to get Ms. Mentor's opinion on. The first one relates to the tools at the disposal of the Human Rights Commission to discharge its constitutional mandate. You've referred to the reporting mechanism. You've referred to the need to require government departments to report to it with regard to certain issues. But beyond reporting, what concrete powers does the Human Rights Commission have to enforce its findings relating to human rights abuse, or to interrogate, for that matter, human rights abuse.
I think the South African Human Rights Commission can recommend prosecution and redress where human rights abuses have been violated. So that is one tool that they can use. And the tool of prosecution, I think, is a very powerful tool that I've never heard of. I might be ignorant that the Human Rights Commission ever used the tool. But also, if you go to Chapter 3 of the Constitution, that chapter deals with corporate governance. I think the Human Rights Commission can use its founding Chapter 9 together with that chapter to find ways and means of dealing with abuses, if it is the abuses by government institutions or organs of state. But outside organs of state, the private sector, for instance, the farm owners, etc., I think the Human Rights Commission can use research to find out, or if not do research by itself, it can institute, commission research, and find out and make recommendations, either to the powers that be, like Parliament, etc., to do something about the abuse and redress thereof where it happens, or to recommend prosecution when necessary, as I said.
If I can just follow up, Richard. Obviously, the prosecuting authority ultimately has the authority to decide whether to prosecute or not. So that route does have its own limitations. Let me put it slightly differently. In your opinion, if the Human Rights Commission is of the view that concrete action is to be taken to enforce human rights in a particular situation, obviously it's not a court, it's not a prosecuting authority, but do you think that it has the authority to take legal action in its own right, in court, maybe through civil action against the individual or individuals, or bring some kind of application to court to actually get a court which has the power to actually enforce its views? Obviously, it's up to the court to decide whether it agrees with its assertions or not. But do you believe that the Human Rights Commission it is within its mandate or power to bring court action against anybody or any institution which, in its opinion, is violating human rights?
Yes. Firstly, I said it can recommend. It does not have a power to recommend. It can recommend, does not have the power to prosecute. But yes, I agree with you fully. The Human Rights Commission can and should institute legal processes in its own name where it feels that human rights have been violated. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Mento, any questions for us as a committee, or questions perhaps to the representative from the commission who is here?
I have
one question to the panel and one question to the commission. To the panel, what is the likely date if people are appointed of an assumption of duty? I know the parliament, the processes are tardy because it's National Assembly together with the president, but I needed a projection, which if it's not very accurate. To the commission, I would like to ask the remuneration package. I'm asking this not because if it's too little, I would opt out. I would still opt in. But just to prepare myself in advance to go and plan, should I be appointed, if I need to cut the budget or whatever.
Just in terms of process, we're hoping we've got a report by next week. So we're hoping to take the report and obviously the recommendation to the House get it through the National Assembly by next week, and then put it forward to the president. Obviously, it would depend on, because you know, on the candidate as well, and we would obviously then put it into a, into the report and ask that the person be appointed. But my understanding was that it is as soon as possible, because it is a position that has been vacant for in fact a few years, I think. But yeah, I mean, it would also be dependent on the candidate to say, because it might be a case where somebody has to give notice somewhere else or whatever the case is. But we can work that in. But my understanding is as soon as possible. We've got the salary breakdowns. I don't know which. Cindy, have you? Oh, okay. We might not have it. Well, Cindy's looking for it. Maybe I think could, if you have the information from your age. From the HR department, it would seem normal commissioners, the inclusive package for 2007 was 550, but they have been just been given, I think, a 7.5% increase. So that would be the all-in inclusive package. The revised, that was for 2007. The package for 2008, total package was 581, and then, as I said, for next year, there's another 7.5%. So you're looking at about 600,000, but that's inclusive package. And then the commission, the chairperson, obviously, deputy chair and chair, obviously, a little bit higher.
One last question. You expect you can reside where you reside, or you are you expected to move towards where the commission is located?
I actually discussed that with Mr. Colliban over the phone. In the past, as I understood it, Deputy Chair, there were commissioners in various provincial offices and at head office. But that is, at the moment, I think all the commissioners are in Joburg, if I get all the full-time ones.
Thank you very much, In the past, we only had commissioners in Cape Town and Johannesburg. We didn't opt for the arrangement whereby, for example, CGE have commissioners all over the provinces. We're all based in Johannesburg, and we prefer it that way for now, until such time that perhaps the next commission decides to, have another arrangement where you have commissioners based in provinces. That is a debate we've been having for a while, and I think we've reached a point where we think that the provinces need the presence of commissioners. But we haven't got that on paper. Yeah.
Maybe to add, the chair said something about if it's not possible for somebody in the Joburg office, then at least from the Cape Town office, because obviously there is an existing office down here as well. But so I think in for Cape Town it would be easier, but not generally across until the decision is.
Yes, until the decision. But we have offices now in all the provinces. Thank you.
Let me thank you, Chairperson. And say that should I be appointed, I am ready and willing to take the position, irrespective of the fact that I might have to relocate again. I consciously went through all these possibilities when I applied for this, and I also went through the possibility that I could be taking another cut in income, but I'm willing to do this for my people and for my country. Thank you.
And just thank you for your time. We just want a 5-minute break. We've got 5 minutes.
I was going to say, yeah. I can stop. Sorry, I didn't want to even know how to. right.
You have no right.
It was CV number 67. It's in the green folder that members have. Just to advise members, we've also been informed that our 12 o'clock candidate, Mr. Krull, has written to Cindy and advised that he is withdrawing his nomination. We have, in the break, tried to move the 2 o'clock candidate to 12 o'clock. Unfortunately, she's not available. So we're going to take Mrs. Kadali, then have a two-hour lunch. Well, not a two-hour lunch, we just have a two-hour break.
Good.
Mike can always take us to lunch. So, and then at 2 o'clock, we'll then have Ms. Briggs Govender coming in at 2. So, Mrs. Kadali, welcome. And nice to see you again. The members have your CV. They've gone through it. Just by way of introduction, I don't know who of the members you have met and who you don't know, but just maybe to run through. Dr. Gavin Woods, Ms. Annelise van Wyk, Mr. Rose Sontor, Ms. Elizabeth Ngaleka, Mr. J.B. Sibanyoni, and Mr. Len Hubert, and right at the end, our Deputy Chairperson from the Human Rights Commission, who is not on the panel, but just here to answer questions should candidates have questions that the committee cannot answer. At the end there, Ms. Dean Smuts, whom you know, that is Sue Ann Isaacs, our research assistant. Mr. Simmons was here, I'm sure he'll be back. Mr. Mike Masuta, Ms. Sybil Seaton, I'm Carol Johnson, and Cindy Barley from the committee section. So over to you, maybe just to start the process, just a brief introduction of your skills, your expertise, what you've done in the past, and then I'll open up to members for questions.
I am a former academic. I studied at the University of the Western Cape. I did a degree in library science, honors in social anthropology, a master's in women's and development studies in The Hague, Holland. I came back from Holland and I set up the Gender Equity Institute at the University of the Western Cape and designed a whole lot of policies on gender equality, the advancement of women in academia, but we did such a lot of work that we created a network of women who majorly influenced the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and inserting clauses about women's equality into the Constitution. And I think in a way, the University of the Western Cape was a training ground for my feminist activism, my work in women's rights. And so I come with a lot of skills in terms of policy, program implementation, design, and activism. Unlike other universities that had gender programs, ours was linked to real feminist activism. I designed a women's studies winter school for ordinary women, working class women, who came on a regular basis to do basic courses in gender equality, women and labor, women and reproductive rights, and so on. And through that work, the Workers' College, which was started by the trade union movement, which operated at the university, then asked me to teach as well in the Workers' College. And so we did a lot of training on gender equality, women and labor rights, in the Workers' College. In 1995, I was one of the nominees for the Human Rights Commission, and I served there for 3 years. And I think my track record speaks for itself. I did a lot of work in the prisons, investigating farm worker abuse. I investigated the children's institutions, And a lot of this got coverage in the newspaper. And I can talk to you about that later on. I then left the Human Rights Commission and set up the District 6 Land Claims Unit. And I think we were a flagship office. We didn't get much money from the state, which was unfortunate, because when I was interviewed, I was told I'd get $1.5 million budget. After 6 months, no money was forthcoming. And I raised a lot of money from USAID. And I think it was the only land claims office in the country that imported map information software. And we were quite innovative in how we dealt with land claims. The land claims process is a tedious, long legal process. And it takes about 30 pages to investigate each land claim. What we did quite innovatively was to provide people with a map of the original District 6. We then superimposed the current District 6, and we plotted their claims on this map. So people could, by looking at the map, immediately see what the status of their claim is. Is it still there? Is the land still there? Should they be compensated? Et cetera, et cetera. So on one page, we could give people the status of their claim, and through that, they could see whether they were eligible for compensation, for land restitution, alternative land, et cetera, et cetera. And that, when USAID saw that, they gave us more money, and they gave us the computers with the required soft information software. So that was quite a flagship. And I left after a year for political reasons, which, if you're interested, I'll tell you. Since then, I've set up the Impumelelo Innovations Awards Trust, and we reward excellence in the public sector. My program is one of 10 international partners: China, the Philippines, Brazil, Mexico, Kenya, Mexico, Peru, Chile, Brazil. And what we do is to look at public-private partnerships that improve the quality of life for the poor. I've run that program now for 9 years, and it is, since we started much later than our 10 international partners, I've overtaken all of them internationally, and he's really the flagship. And if you're interested, you can see my materials, which are being exported all over the world. Yeah, that's largely what I do.
Thanks. Over to members. The hands who... Lynn, was that it? No. Okay. Mr. Yubad, Ms. Smuck, you had a hand up. Ms. Ngaleka, Mr. Sibanyoni, Ms. Van Beek, Mr. Sonto. Okay, now hang on. How many have we got now? Mr. Yubad, Ms. Smut, then it was Mrs. Ngaleka, then Mr. Sibanyoni, Ms. Van Beek, and Mr. Sonto, in that order. How could I forget Mr. Masuta? He will never forgive me. And we've got just under an hour, so I think maybe let's try to keep it as brief as we can. Okay, Mr. Hubert.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Kazali, I see you did serve on the Human Rights Commission for 3 years in the past. Can you explain to us why you left the Human Rights Commission at that stage?
When I was nominated to the Human Rights Commission, it was a great honor. And I always considered it the definitive job for me, for my personality, for my independence. And, of course, the Human Rights Commission started with us, and so there were lots of teething problems. I felt under the leadership that we were obsessed with salaries and furniture and offices, when we had a minefield of human rights issues to deal with. Fortunately for me, I ran the Western Cape Human Rights Commission's office, and my job was to take complaints from the public, but also to monitor legislation. And so we did that fantastically well. I mean, you know, there's a whole track record in the newspapers. But increasingly, there was conflict between my office and the main office about the fact that I wasn't interested in fancy furniture. I ran the Human Rights Commission out of my office for more than a, out of my home for more than a year. While my colleagues were getting furniture and offices, I was actually dealing with the public, and for me, that was of minor importance. And so there was a lot of conflict about the priorities in the commission, what should be dealt with first, and what kind of program of action should we adopt. And in a way, my office was streets ahead of the headquarters. And I think simply because I got tired about talking about salary and office furniture and where we should be located, et cetera, et cetera. But I wasn't alone. Some of our senior commissioners, Max Coleman, left. And Max Coleman was a definitive human rights campaigner before 1994. When Max left, it was really quite shocking. Helen Sussman left. Anne Routier left. And I left. And I think that in a way, the conflict could have been dealt with better. But I wasn't happy with the leadership. Okay, Dean?
Thank you. Rhoda, should you be reappointed to the Human Rights Commission, I'd like to ask how you would deal with certain matters which are arising. Mr. Jacob Zuma, now in the course of public appearances, is making various interesting suggestions, one of it, which is that the death penalty should be reconsidered or reinstated. Another, that the right to silence should be removed. He's making those particularly, I see, as one category, the criminal justice rights. He's also talking about the problem of teenage pregnancies, and as I understand the reportage, he's proposing that babies should be taken away from their mothers. Now, I would like to know if you were reappointed to the commission, how you would deal with these issues. Quite clearly, in the case of the death penalty and the right to silence, they would find effect in some sort of proposed amendment to the Criminal Procedure Act and the Constitution and so forth, and no doubt in the case of the mothers, there would also be legislation. But what array of actions would you propose, or would it be appropriate at all for the Commission to react? And then a second, just a subordinate question. One of your activities is the writing of a column for Business Day, and which is these days picked up by Die Burger. And like every columnist, it is clearly part of your role to be somewhat provocative, if you don't mind my putting it that way. And I'd like to know how you would reconcile that persona with a commissionership, or whether perhaps you don't see any conflict. Perhaps you think that a commissioner should also be, should stir things up.
Thank you for that, for those questions. On the columnist matter, I would give it up. When I was a Human Rights Commissioner, I wrote a lot of articles about issues, about the death penalty, in fact, about abortion, and I did put those things in the public domain. But I wasn't a columnist. A columnist's role is different. You take sides, you're opinionated, you can be provocative. And I would seriously give it up, even though I like it very much. In fact, in my current job, my board asked me to give up my column, and I said no. My column predated this job, and it's my right to freedom of expression. And so I shall write, but I won't be a columnist.
But would you be less provocative?
What does it mean to be provocative? Provocative means freedom of speech. It means freedom of opinion. It means raising issues when they need to be raised. It means speaking truth to power. So I might not be a columnist, but I will write, which I have done since birth. So, with regards to the ANC president on the death penalty, the right to silence teenage pregnancy, when I was a Human Rights Commissioner, one of my key jobs was legislation monitoring for compliance. And what we did, every utterance that smacked of threats to the Constitution, every law that came out, I had a legislation monitor, a lawyer who was trained in legislation monitoring. And what we did was she went to Parliament, she sat in portfolio committees and brought every piece of legislation to the office so that we could scrutinize it for compliance. We then became part of the parliamentary legal monitoring group, and so we would bounce ideas off each other and collectively or separately write a report. So there was a critical mass of NGOs who did legislation monitoring, and we would give voice to the issues that that we were concerned about. We also went to portfolio committees and aired our views there, and if necessary, we wrote in the papers. But one can also mobilize the public around issues, and I think we were quite good at that. So it's as simple as that, that one holds politicians accountable to the Constitution. Chapter 9 says the Human Rights Commission is a state organization supporting democracy. And any threats to democracy and constitutional democracy, one has to take head on, no matter who. And I think I come with that track record of fearlessness, that politicians are public servants and should be accountable to Parliament, to the public, and to the Constitution.
Okay, Ms. Ngaleka, and then after that I've got Mrs. Sibanyoni.
Thank you, Jefferson. Ms. Khadale, you mentioned in your first reply that you were not happy with the leadership at the South African Human Rights Commission there. I'd like to know, as a professional, how do you deal with conflict? Because in every world situation, you'll get conflict. And the solution is that we need to deal with conflict in the right manner. So by not being happy, you opted to leave instead of dealing with whatever problem you have. So what guarantees do we have if you are appointed that you might not be happy with the current leadership and leave again? Secondly, I'd like to know what's your opinion on the following, that despite the younger South Africans growing up in a multiracial environment, there have been notable incidents of racial tension amongst the youth. How does the South African Human Rights address this situation, and what can be done to prevent future incidents of this nature? Thank you very much.
Thank you for those questions. I can truly say that on paper, I raised issues. I even wrote to President Nelson Mandela to list the number of grievances. I think what the committee should understand is the Human Rights Commission is an independent organization, and often people can use independence for other persons not to scrutinize it. Who are the gatekeepers of the gatekeepers? And so it was very difficult to raise issues in such a setting where people would say government has no right to interfere in the commission and other organizations. So what we did, all of us who had complaints, we tabled them, we brought them to a plenary, and it was a matter of how the grievances were dealt with. Ironically, Barney Pityana and I got on very well because my job was to monitor the Western Cape and the Northern Cape, and he was very happy with my work. But he was also quite recalcitrant about listening to the complaints within the commission. And so the person who was the most approachable and kind and easy to work with was Max Coleman. Max wasn't confrontational. But he and Barney had a difference of opinion. They called a meeting. And after that, Max said, I'm leaving. And as much as we tried to intervene as a commission, it was finished in club. With Pityana, I had a decent enough relationship with Pityana to raise the issue. But there was a point at which the entire commission supported me in my grievance. But there was just a block in terms of resolving the issues at a fair and impartial conflict resolution wasn't part of the scene. And I think if you look at the entire trajectory of that commission, there was a hemorrhaging of top personnel which we should never have lost. So it wasn't just only me, And I trained at UWC. I was on the tribunal. I know about conflict resolution. I know what steps to follow. And I did all of that civilly, decently, respectfully. And at some point, you give up. And I did. I must admit to you that I regretted having left. I think many of the commissioners who left regretted having left and regretted not having put up a better fight. But I think we were also starry-eyed. It was 1995. We were comrades. We were going to work together in a spirit of collegiality. And I think the race after 1994 to fat salaries and cars and overtook us. And as an activist, I didn't want to be a part of that game. So conflict resolution, I have been in many conflictual situations and have dealt with it very well. In fact, I advised the Vice Chancellor at UWC on conflict resolution. I set up tribunals, feminist, gender-sensitive tribunals, where Kada Asmal was chairman and Tito Mbaweni was chairman and Penwell Maduna, and so they know of that track record. I just think the leadership was a bit of a problem. Your racial tension question, one of my favorite questions. In the commission, we had a debate as to whether we should take complaints from the public, individual complaints, or whether we should deal with structural problems like prison rights, prisoners' rights, and so on. I was the only office that said, let's do both. When people come with an individual complaint, it often points to complaints in the system. And I'll give you one example. And one day I got a call from a black man from Gugulethu. He said, my brother drank poison, and I phoned the ambulance services, and I said, please send me an ambulance service. I think my brother's dying. He drank poison. The operator said, what a dumb darkie. Let him die. I was shocked at this. Now, in the commission, we also said, let's not be heavy-handed because we've got powers of search and seizure and subpoena. I go to the head of the administration service, and I said, I got this complaint, and I'd like you to point me to the operator, and I want a transcript of that conversation. They wouldn't give it. I then used my powers of subpoena, and I got the transcript. But from the transcript, it was clear that routinely black people were denied ambulance services, and that colored, Indian, and white areas got them first. We then looked at a whole lot of transcripts of conversations of black people, and it was clear that there was discrimination. Discrimination that denied people emergency services. I then said to the head of the ambulance services, listen, I can take this guy to court, but I'm going to do it more constructively. I want a public apology from this office to the person, and I want you to allow us as a Human Rights Commission to come and train you every Saturday on human rights issues. Believe it or not, the colored guy who was the operator who was racist towards the black guy. He came forward, and he acknowledged what he had done, and he said he was going to do a public apology. We got the cameras. It was headline, and he said, I'm sorry I called you a dumb darkie. The irony was that the colored man was blacker than the black man. And so it was very powerful. It was on the front pages of the newspaper. Secondly, every Saturday as a Human Rights Commission, we went and trained the personnel about human rights. It's the best partnership that could have happened because of that. So there was an individual complaint that pointed that there was a problem in the system, structural racism. And I dealt with it fantastically well. It got headline coverage, it became public, and people were then prepared to educate themselves. Another case, a black woman worked for a top medical company, medical services company in Cape Town. The doctor's purse disappeared, and he immediately accused her. But more than that, he not only accused the black woman, the tea woman, he also made a strip. That's the kind of stuff we had to deal with. And I can tell you, there's nothing better for a human rights commission to stand up to a powerful medical company to defend the rights of an ordinary black woman. That's the power that we have to change this country. And that is why I'm a bit disappointed often in the Human Rights Commission, because they don't take those complaints and make it a structural thing and show the public our job is not just to criticize government, but it's to help government build a sensitive democracy. So that was my job.
Ms. Sibanyoni, then Mr. Sonto, then Ms. Van Dyk. Then I had Mike, or you wanted Mike, do you want to be right at the end, because, or do you want to come in?
Yeah, in
case. Okay. Okay, and then Dr. Woods.
Thank you, Chairperson. Ms. Kadale, I'm going to lay the basis of the questions I'm going to ask you, and I will try to be as brief as possible.
So, your name, sir?
Sibanyoni.
Sibanyoni.
Yes. I'm
Sibanyoni.
JB.
Yeah.
Right. Because you are the candidate who has been with the Human Rights Commission and who has left it, as the committee, ad hoc committee, we felt it maybe it is necessary to try and find out more about yourself, more especially for your time when you were with the commission. And we were provided with some of the documents. Now, when we gleaned through those documents, for example, we found out that you were a commissioner was appointed by Nelson Mandela. And then also we find out that you took a decision at a stage to resign. And then that there was a lot of negotiations, persuasion, trying to get you to reverse your decision to withdraw your resignation. That it didn't, you didn't withdraw it until the time the notice which you have given expired. Namely, you said until December 31st, 1997, until you went into the new year, 1998. But the documents also show that, in my view, it would appear you had a problem of accepting authority. And number two, it also showed that you had a personality problem, failing to work with other colleagues, staff members, and the like. If I may quote some of, I'll just quote some few excerpts from the information that we received. It says here, Ms. Kadale continued to have bad relations with staff at all levels, was often rude, refused to write reports when requested to do so, attended the meeting only as it pleases her. And further on, it also says relations with other commissioners were no better. If I go on further, it says, the result of all this, she addressed a letter to me, that is Bani Pichane, dated 19 August 1996, resigning from the commission with immediate effect. And then further on, it says, Ms. Kadale then went on a media campaign against the commission. Further on, that's where it says, among this representation and offer of mediation, there was an offer of mediation by a certain Miss Alison Tiley, from the Black Sesh, and apparently you agreed on a certain condition to say you wanted autonomy for the Western Cape office. It goes to failing to submit to authority. You wanted the Western Cape office, which you were manning, to be autonomous. And then she says, meanwhile, press reports emanating from Cape Town show that Ms. Kadali had organized her own farewell function. While those negotiations were going on, you had organized a farewell function. At the function, a petition was circulated calling for the reinstatement of Rhoda Kadali. At this event, Ms. Kadali called for my resignation as the chairperson of the commission. So that's the picture that one gets when going through all the correspondence that we received. And I hear you this morning that you are blaming the chairperson, Dr. Bani Pichane, as being incompetent, who has been difficult, and the like. I want to have your comment on this.
I've just written down exactly what you said. Bad relations with staff at all levels, refused to write reports, attended meetings only when it pleases her. That is defamatory. I can take them to court and I'll win. I was the one commissioner that had a track record of writing reports for every plenary meeting. In fact, they were so, informative that Barney asked me if I could come to Joburg to train the other staff. I was the only office that had a legal complaints officer who was a computer fundy, and every week we could print out how many complaints we had from prisons, how many we had from farm workers, etc., etc. So that statement is just defamatory. I wrote reports most extensively, unlike other commissions, and I've got them all at home. I've got copies of every plenary report. In fact, others wanted me to train them. So that's a gross lie. Secondly, bad relations with staff at all levels is another lie. In fact, the staff wanted me to be located to Joburg so I could train them. And, you know, I don't want to say bring the other commissioners here to witness to the fact of Jody Colopin. Tony Colopin, Kathy Govender, were unhappy that I was leaving. And we did attempt a mediation. And at the main mediation, after that mediation, Helen Sussman, who most didn't want me to leave, she said, if you leave today, I won't blame you. So it takes two to tango. I was prepared to give and take, but there are certain conditions that one can only deal with. The thing that Alison Tilley mediated and that I organized my own farewell. I mean, I'm not that vain to organize my own farewell. I've had many farewells in my life which I haven't organized. So that with respect, is also a misrepresentation. Failing to submit to authority, my track record speaks for itself. I was for 21 years at the University of the Western Cape, where I worked with the authorities on gender policy, gender equality, the advancement of women. We were so successful that in the end, there was no conflict between management and the Women's Commission. Professor Gerwel was my boss. Professor Gerwel, with the Senate, with the faculties, worked together with me on designing a gender, even a non-sexist language policy. I was so good at working with management that all these things were just adopted. It was the non-sexist language policy and the gender policy were the most controversial. But by the time it got to Senate, people voted unanimously for it. The press covered my resignation because they know that I was a good commissioner. It wasn't about me vilifying. It was about the fact that Barney Pityana started the commission very controversially. He called Judge Dennis Davis, a human rights judge, a racist. That catapulted the commission into a very negative limelight from the start. In fact, today I'm ashamed of myself because I supported, when Barney Pityana called Dennis Davis a racist, I tried to tell the world why Barney did it, even though he was wrong.
And to my shame, I defended Dennis Davis against, Barney Pityana against Dennis Davis. And so I don't have a personality problem. I've run my current job for 9 years, and I have the most fantastic staff. There are no hierarchical issues. There are no boss-staff relationships. We're all equal. The same with the way I ran the office here. It wasn't about autonomy. The commission decided because Parliament is here, I should be here. And the fact is that it was an office that was very efficient. It did its work, and its track record spoke for itself. So there was an attempt at mediation. But a mediation is also about give and take. You know, you can't mediate and the boss tells you, no, this is what I want and this is what you will have. In fact, we have human rights legislation that determines how the office is run. And that legislation was violated by our leadership. So, I will defend myself. And I've got evidence to prove that I wasn't difficult, that I had bad relations with all staff is a gross lie, and that, in fact, as a commission, whenever we went on delegations and visits, we were the spokesperson on what we were doing, openly and honestly and transparently. Barney Pityana loved my work. He went with me monitoring the farms in the Northern Cape and the prisons. He was amazed at what I had achieved. I took him around to meet the generals in the Western Cape. And I can modestly tell you, very few commissioners did what I did.
Just a short follow-up. Why should he write now all these negative things about you? Can you give us a reason?
Because I did expose what was wrong within the commission. Because for me, the commission was more important than personalities. And it was very clear that the commission could be destroyed with a hemorrhaging of good staff. And that as much as we wrote about it, Parliament didn't know how to deal with it. Because, you know, every year we write a glossy report, and in a glossy report you can cover up what is really going on. Parliamentarians didn't come to the party. Parliamentarians were supposed to scrutinize that report and to ask key and crucial questions. So it doesn't mean that because you're a leader, you're above reproach. Leaders too have their faults, as I have. And it's the leader's duty when there are problems is to sort them out. But when five commissioners leave, when the legal officer who is a highly skilled person leaves, but Talisa Tipinyani left and came back, the current CEO, then one has to ask a question. When all your staff are leaving, you have to ask a question. Maybe the problem wasn't me.
Okay, members, we've got 15 minutes left, and we've got four people to ask questions. We've we're already over time. So, Mr. Saunter, Ms. van Wyk, Dr. Woods, and Mike, and then we have to close.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I had questions, but the term that this process is taking now makes me to shorten those questions. Ms. Kadali, it seems as if you still have a gripe with the commission. You will take them to court, that is the chairperson to say. And I don't know why you think we should consider you for this position or as a commissioner if still you have a gripe with the commission. I think I must say it up front that the intention of Parliament is to build a nation, and the Commission is one agent, therefore, that should be assisting Parliament in building a nation. If, therefore, the very institution, therefore, is going to get such a bad reflection from, I will say, from you in particular, why do you think we should consider you? Thank you.
Firstly, I didn't say I will. I said if I should, on the basis of that statement, if I took people to court, it's defamation, I'd win. I didn't say I will, because I've no reason to. It's water under the bridge, it's passed. If I had a gripe with, against the commission, then I wouldn't have accepted the nomination. The commission is above all of us. And I agree with you that it's there to build a nation. And in the work that I did, I tried to build community. I tried to build communities of best practice. And I tried to contribute to building a nation. And because the commission is an agent of change, of supporting democracy, I think its work should be taken seriously. And I think we as commissioners should be taken seriously. And the commissioners should be questioned about their work. They should be scrutinized. They should be interrogated. And it's so often the small fish are interrogated, but not the big fish. And then your question, why should I be considered? Because I think I have a track record on doing the kind of work that improves quality of life for the poor. I am a very strong Democrat, and I think the Human Rights Commission is one of the most important institutions in this country to build democracy. And I also think it should be seen to be doing that work. You know, you can have a lot of workshops on building race relations, but if you take a case like the ambulance services to the newspaper, you educate a nation. I did a number of investigations of the prison. And then I got all the prison authorities together to study the Bill of Rights. I then began to form a network within the prison leadership and prison management on how they can really integrate, build rehabilitation and reintegration programs into the prison service. So I think my track record speaks for itself. If you are thinking of a commissioner that will deliver the goods, I can guarantee you that. I've got an enormous database that is evidence of the goods that I have delivered. I've investigated children's homes. I've investigated farm workers' rights. I've been to farmers. I've spoken to them in the Northern Cape and the Western Cape. For me, that's more important than personality issues. It is about building this country. And everywhere people say, you know, there's a lack of capacity. Now, I have got that capacity. And I'm prepared to offer it to my country.
Short question. Which issues would you say, which human rights issues currently would you say should be the priority?
I think the xenophobia explosion was a lesson for the commission of how they have ignored an issue that repeatedly showed its face but people didn't respond. For example, I wrote a column. Within a matter of a month, we had 30 Somalis killed. And I think the commission should have taken that up immediately. And I think it waited for the thing to boil over before it acted. In fact, it had been proactive. The commission does, on paper, have a xenophobia campaign. They have a policy on xenophobia. But there was no kind of boots-on activism in educating the public about xenophobia, about foreigners, about how you treat other people with respect. And the way one deals with that is to you target the media, you train the journalists, you go to schools, you educate the public in NGOs and fora that there are around the country. So that's one very important issue. Secondly, I think the effects of HIV/AIDS on young women. I've just organized a big HIV/AIDS workshop. South Africa has been depopulated of its economically active young women because it's the profile of 15 to 25 that are most affected by HIV and AIDS. And somehow, that group is not being targeted. So if I were a human rights commissioner, I would actually do a lot of work on seeing how we can target that category of people. Gender-based violence, still the violence against women and children, and then looking at systemic issues the rights of prisoners, because I think crime is so prevalent, people think one should lock up prisoners and throw away the key. And I think it's very wrong. I think a democracy is measured by how it treats its vulnerable, its children, and those behind closed doors. And I think we forget that prisoners are released, and when they are released, they will recommit crime because the recidivism rate is very high. So it's important that we create a scenario where prisoners' rights are seen. So there are many, many more. Customary law. There was one woman, we got a complaint in the Human Rights Commission of a black woman whose husband had died, and the community wanted her to go into mourning for a month. And she said, I can't, I'm a single parent, I have to go and work. She took a case to the Human Rights Commission, and she won. But the chiefs ostracized her. The community ostracized her. So even though the commission ruled in her favor, she had to flee that community. And so you have to look at not only how you promote and protect people's rights, but how do you make it possible, once they've won their rights, to continue in that society. Okay, Dr. Woods, and then Mike, and then you have to close it.
Thank you. You know, your interest in the commission from its earliest days, just no doubt since you've left, you followed the progress and the development of the commission. How do you see that development? How do you see the commission today with its current commissioners? What are the positives you see, both in style and in substance? And with this image you have of the current commission, what makes you believe that you would fit in there comfortably and be able to relate to the work they do and make the contributions you've just spoken about?
The current commission, let me tell you frankly, this nomination came like a bolt out of the blue. And I haven't, frankly, been following the commission's activities. I do read it when the commission raises issues on racism within the media. The Anglo-American report that just came out, the commission submitted an explosive report on the rights of communities. And in fact, somebody wrote me a comment about that report. So that is the most recent thing that I took an interest in. I always think that the commission has important work to do. I find the commission a bit invisible. I only know of Jodie Colliphant, and I don't know who the other commissioners are, frankly. I know Tipaniani quite well. And because the commission doesn't have an office here, the one that I set up, commissioners have come and gone, so there's no longevity. Leon Vessels followed in my footsteps, but often when I contacted him, I couldn't find him. And I often acted on his behalf because people thought I was still a commissioner. So he was a very absent commissioner. And that's my perspective on the commission, that it's not very visible, that it doesn't engage Parliament on issues that are very explosive, like the xenophobia violence. If I were the head of the commission, I would engage Parliament and the community and NGOs on how can we help government deal with this problem. It's a very difficult problem to deal with if you don't create networks and structures to deal with it. There are refugee committees that proliferate. There are legal aid clinics that deal with refugees. Bring them all on board, and then one can deal with it proactively in a structural way.
My final question, maybe just to correct, Parliament was briefed by the Commission on the xenophobia. Our Justice Committee was briefed, so just in defense of the Commission. Mike?
Maybe I can actually add that I was one of the members of the Parliamentary Committee that worked closely with the Commission in dealing with the issue of xenophobia. We visited the areas affected, and we had several meetings with the representatives of the affected persons, etc. I don't need to go into that, but I can certainly confirm that the Commission was directly involved in that whole process.
Can I then say, why didn't we avert this catastrophe? If organization was so active and it did have a program, why did this take people unawares when, as a columnist, not even as a commissioner, I dealt with it?
Can I raise a point of order? I think that the purpose of the interview is for the candidate to answer questions and not to ask questions. There certainly are answers. We investigated as a parliamentary committee as to the source of the xenophobia violence, and we were able to trace it to a specific location, to an organized kind of initiative that happened at a particular point. So I don't think it would be fair to simply reduce it to leveling blame on the commission as such. But I don't think that the subject of our discussion is really the xenophobia problem. Certainly there is a report of Parliament that I think is public, and there have been a debate in Parliament on the matter, which you are at liberty to go and go through, and that would acquaint you with the real issues and the challenges that arose out of that situation. I don't know if the Commission itself would have written any reports following the repatriation efforts and, I mean, the reintegration efforts that ensued. But I just wanted to check something. You obviously are a very passionate and fiery person. In your opinion, if somebody were to ask you to self-evaluate yourself, short of saying self-critique yourself, what would you regard as your weaknesses that could possibly impede your ability to effectively discharge your duties, if any, as a commissioner, if appointed?
I think one of my weaknesses is that I'm intolerant of any organization being sidetracked to what it should be doing. So if one loses focus, and I feel that the vision is clear, that we've had many meetings about it, and the commission doesn't focus, I am quite intolerant of that. I'm very much a person that is focused on, if you get a job, if you apply for a job and you think you're qualified to do it, then do it. And if you need training, and that's what I do with my staff, I employ people, and I'm very good at seeing where the gaps are, and I give them additional training and opportunities for training. I find it very difficult. I was when I was the head of the land claims unit, I had a colleague who never did his work, and I agonized for days how to deal with him. And I had to control myself in how, consciously had to tell myself, the best way to deal with him is to put him in office with a colleague who has the same job. So they were both employed to do research. The one colleague churned out 5 reports every month, and the other one none. And it was simply by putting them together that the message got through. I also looked at his reports vis-a-vis the other colleagues, and I took a red pen, and I said, this is not good enough. And so I was I had to tell myself, how do you deal sensitively with a colleague that is irritating you, that is driving me crazy? And so when I was younger, I would have been petulant. I would have exploded. But in my later years, I've learned as an employer how to get the best out of colleagues. So that's a flaw that I have, that I can be quite impatient with people who are not coming to the party, the people who don't deliver the goods. But I've also found ways of getting colleagues to do that. Another weakness is that I'm not very good at I'm very good at financial accountability, but I can't read a finance report. For example, there is not a cent out of place in my organization. I raise $1 million a year to give away to top public service projects. And I'm not like Gavin Woods, who can scrutinize accounts, but I look at a financial statement and I know there's something wrong. So that's a weakness. A weakness is that I'm not a good accountant, but I am very good at looking after the pennies. Nothing goes wrong. Nothing cannot be accounted for.
Hence my initial observation that you're quite a fiery and passionate person. I can see you struggle to contain that fire in you.
But we need both types. We need phlegmatics and dry types.
I assume. In certain instances, one can't really hold that against you. Just in terms of the institution itself and its location within the broader democratic order, there's this concept of independence. Relating to a whole range of constitutional institutions. Do you believe this is one of the institutions that must have as one of its attributes independence? And if so, how would you define that independence? Independence from whom or from what, in respect of what? Or is it something that doesn't arise at all?
Well, it's here in the Constitution. On page 103, it says these institutions are independent and subject only to the Constitution and the law. They must be impartial and exercise their powers and perform their functions without fear, favor, or prejudice. We are a country torn apart by partiality, by people taking sides. And every state institution has been affected by the taking of sides, and it can destroy an institution. And I think one of the most important functions and qualities of a human rights commission is to be independent, and that is one of the first debates that we had around the table. And I must credit Barney Pitiano with that. The first plenary, F.W. de Klerk, for example, brought a complaint to the Human Rights Commission. You know, and we were all anti-F.W. de Klerk. And we had to put our cards on the table as a commission. And we said, this commission is subject to Parliament and the Constitution. And we have to treat everybody impartially, without fear or favor. And how are we going to deal with F.W. de Klerk's complaint? We have to reassure F.W. that he can come to this commission and bring his complaint. In the same way as Buthelezi can, the same way as every other member of parliament or member of the public can. So I think independence is crucial for the Chapter 9 institutions, because if you are seen to be taking sides, you can destroy parliament. You can destroy constitutional bodies that should be seen to be protecting the public. So if the public protector is not impartial in investigating the deputy president's trip to Dubai, then that creates a problem for other people who bring complaints. And I was on a panel with Judge Dennis Davis the other day about the judiciary and the role of the judiciary. Is the judiciary being compromised by taking sides? And I came down quite hard on the judiciary because I felt that it let slip certain values, hence it's in trouble today. So there are huge cases today in our country that show that partiality has created problems for state institutions, and that one should be absolutely scrupulous in how one practices independence, that you don't favor your friends and your cronies when it comes to providing services, because it will backfire, and it does. Okay.
Just finally, if I may, quickly.
So, you finally is never finally.
Come
on, Mike. No, it's fine. Go for it.
Are there any particular... Sorry. Believe you me, I would be asking many questions after.
No.
Are there any particular biases that you could be bringing into the job if you were appointed that you would wish to disclose or bring to the attention of the panel?
I think it's
if any.
It's a very interesting question because I think we all come with our bias. My bias is that I'm a black woman, that I come with a perspective on how HIV/AIDS is decimating our country of black women, so I'm going to fight that fight. The bias is pro-poor. I think it's unacceptable that poverty is so entrenched and embedded in our society and we're not getting out of it. So I come with those biases. I come from a struggle background. My grandfather was a trade union fighter, fight for the rights of workers. And I, when I trained people at the Workers' College, I looked at the position of women in the labor force. I presented a paper to the United Nations on the position of women in South Africa in the labor force. So, yeah, those are my prejudices. I'm not sure if you... I've got 7 brothers, so I'm very anti-men. I joke. I get on very well with men because I've got 7 brothers and a father.
Thank you very much. I'm sure Ms. Dinsmack will kill me if I...
So what?
<It's super. laughs>
Any questions from your side, either to the panel as a whole, or as I say, we've got a representative from the commission. If there are, you know, HR questions,
no,
things
thank
that
you.
The commission
I know, can't answer. I know what the commission is about. Thank you very much for interviewing me.
Yeah. Thank you for your time.
Thank
I
you.
Think, Cindy, if you could just on the program, we've got our last candidate coming at 2:00. And then it might be a good idea to immediately thereafter maybe ask if we can have the tea then at 3:00 to give the members a chance to just go and if people want to meet, members want to meet in their respective study groups, and then we can come back at 3:00.